Welcome to Doha Debates, where we explore an urgent issue from various sides and try to find some common ground. Get ready for a conversation that is well-informed, spirited, civil, and respectful. Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, and I will be your moderator for this debate. And today we're talking about the global policies that factor in race to try and make the world more equitable. Are policies like that necessary? Racism does contribute to inequality in the world. We know that, especially against Black people. Consider a recent survey that showed that the average white Brazilian earned at least 74% more than Black Brazilians. 74%. The average Black American household has just about 6% of the wealth of the average white American household. In South Africa, that share is 5% for Blacks. Now, to address this, dozens of countries have implemented various kinds of affirmative action, policies that will factor race into school admissions or workplace hiring. Some critics advocate a more colorblind approach instead. One critic named Coleman Hughes argues for focusing on economic class or regional background and more or less ignoring race in policy and in life. So how much can race-conscious policies actually achieve? Are they doing more to advance equality or to impede it? Today's guests focus on how parts of Africa are answering these questions, addressing historic traumas, and trying to improve the future. Joining us in Washington is Tondiwe Nchinga. She is a researcher at the Center for the Study of Race, Gender, and Class at the University of Johannesburg. She's also the author of a book about social media and racism in South Africa. Tondiwe Nchinga, welcome to the debate. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Joining us in Austin, Texas is Magat Wade. She is a Senegalese entrepreneur and prosperity activist. She is the author of The Heart of a Cheetah, How We Have Been Lied to About African Poverty and What That Means for Human Flourishing. Magat Wade, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Later, we will include our global listeners with their own perspectives and questions. As always, I have two ground rules. First, no personal attacks. We're here to pick apart the issue, not each other. And second, every question needs a direct answer. It's totally fine to think out loud. I don't know can be a perfectly acceptable answer. But please don't pivot to another topic until you've addressed the question at hand. And please, my very biggest pet peeve, don't answer a question with a question. With all that laid out, Magat, if I may start with you, and the nature of race-based policies, what is your take on whether race-based or race-focused policies are necessary to improve equity in the world?
My general point on this, Joshua, is that I am not sure as to how much it does. If anything, I actually think it backfires and it is counterproductive. It doesn't mean that I'm not saying that racism doesn't exist, but I'm just not sure, like Coleman Hughes, that race-based policies actually do much. And, you know, come in place, we have seen them be unproductive and oftentimes actually really breed negative outcomes. I will just open with that. I like to keep it short. This is where I'm coming from. I'm sure we'll get a chance to unpack, but as a whole, that's my position. I really am not going to stake the future of Black people like me on race-based policies.
Tondiwe, what about you? How do you see it?
I do believe that it is necessary to have policies that address groups that have been historically marginalized, that have historically been disadvantaged structurally. So I do agree that one of those aspects include race and race-based policies for a more equitable society.
Tondiwe, you've argued that programs like affirmative action programs, and different people define affirmative action in a variety of ways, but you've argued that these kinds of programs are necessary in South Africa and elsewhere. And you said that you have a problem with this idea of merit, of the word merit, that there's an issue there. What is that issue?
The idea that these policies, so that Black people are given kind of a college admission solely on the idea of being Black, as if they haven't worked hard, as if they haven't put their own work, that you're literally, you know, just a diversity entry. I don't think that's fair. These are also people who work just as hard. In actual fact, I would say that the opposite is true. whereas we see that whiteness has allowed for people to gain entry solely, mediocrity becomes a way in which entry is based on race. White people can be mediocre when, as Black people, I know plenty of Black people who are raised to be like, you know what, we have to work twice as hard to get in. So I don't see how when suddenly it applies to Black people, there's absolutely no merit.
Magat, you've argued that Africans should cast aside what you call, quote, imposed inferiority to reclaim their innate brilliance, unquote. What do you mean by that?
I know, Joshua, that you said that to answer your question, and I will answer that question, but I just wanted to go back to something that Tendi Wei just said, when she said, you know, some Black people are working as hard, if not more harder than, in some cases, white people, yet you don't see the outcome happening for them. I agree with her that that does happen. Now, should that be a reason for us then to blame merit and to reconsider the concept of merit? I think it's a very dangerous slippery slope to say, oh, some people are working harder, yet they're not getting there, and they're putting it on the name of merit, therefore I'm going to attack the concept of merit. I think it's very dangerous. We should not attack the concept of merit, because I believe merit is as universal as it goes, and it's a good measure to go by. I don't care which skin color you are. I don't care where you come from. This is one measure that we should not be messing with at a great expense. So many of us Black people always invoking whiteness this, whiteness that, white people this, white people that, white people don't want us, white people won't let us, white. And I'm just sitting there and thinking to myself, my grandma, you know, Joshua, before I left, I was raised in an African, in a typical, most as traditional as they go, traditional African village by my grandma, when my parents had to emigrate to Europe in search for a better job so that they can feed us back home. So when one of the things that my grandma told me when it was about time for me to go to Europe, you know, to be reunited with my parents a few years later after their immigration journey has worked. And she said, you're going to go to this place where most people don't look like you and where most people will not speak the same language as you do and where kids there are going to school, something that you have not done despite your age. And she said, but when you go there, I don't want for any of that to intimidate you. And she was using her words very carefully. And she decided to use the word intimidate. Do not be intimidated by any of this. She said, when you go there, yes, many of them are going to have, they're going to look different than you because many of them are going to have a different skin color from yours. But it is all it is. Human skin, different color, but human skin. And you're human. Okay? So I think for me, those words resonated so strongly, and they just don't match when I hear people complaining today about what they call white supremacy. My grandma right there was telling me, you have innate brilliance in you. And it's not because others seem to be succeeding more than you or do something that you don't know about or speaking a different language, but you should take that almost as this inferiority complex. So I, Magat Wade, refuse to ever utter out of my words, out of my mouth, the words, they won't let me. They won't let me. Racism might stand in my way, but it will never, ever stop me from heading where I need to head to. And I think our ancestors have been proving that day in and day out. So I am willing to look at, that's how I look at it.
Tendi Wei, could I get you to jump in on this? I hear where Magat is coming from. I think I had a very similar conversation with my grandmother as well to try to protect me as a Black American from being, to use Magat's word, intimidated by the specter of what race might mean for me. But how do you, Tendi Wei, how do you see this?
I mean, but what it sounds like to me is kind of the things that we talk about, that we need to, you know, we have our Black excellence and, you know, there is Black joy to be shared, but it doesn't mean that we don't have structures that we have to fight against. So even this idea of don't be intimidated to talk about these things and to challenge the status quo is exactly that, to not be intimidated. You know, my background is also in social anthropology, so I look at society, I look at people, I look at humankind and how white people historically and today are really the center of racism. In particularly in anthropology, there's always a look at the other. You know, let's look at the oppressed as opposed to the oppressor. So I look at the oppressor. And in terms of this, I would say that the backlash is that whites, comfort is being disturbed. So for there to be what I call white lash, just kind of white backlash to any type of addressing injustices that have happened, there will be a big outcry. This is unfair. This is wrong. And again, talking about meritocracy, you know, these people don't deserve these spots. These are our spots. And really that forms just historically how loosening power is an incredibly difficult thing for white supremacy.
A lot of people who are in a contemporary setting will say, who could be identified as white. And that definition also shifts depending on where you are in the world, right? Because there's many different views. Many people would say, I understand the need for this, but I'm not the problem. I'm not a racist. I don't understand why I have to be roped into this as if I personally did something to be a part of this problem. I would have no problem hiring a person of color or admitting a person of color to university because I just don't see it that way. And I'm not sure why I even need to be included in programs like this, affirmative action or other race conscious programs or otherwise. I may be white, but I'm not part of the problem. How do you respond to that? How do you address that?
Well, that also, again, just really falls very squarely into theories on white identity, which is that we're allowed to be individualistic. Racism is over there. It's never me. Which also, again, doesn't apply to any other racial group that's being researched. Black people are Black. Indian people are Indian. I'm talking the South African context. Colored people are colored. Suddenly, when it comes to white people, it's like, no, but I'm an individual. This doesn't apply to me. So for me, it's just even textbook of white defenses.
I want to clarify again, before I go back to my gut, you used, I know that different people in different parts of the world who may hear this will use the word colored very differently. In the United States, it's an archaic term for Black people. So for you as someone from Africa, what do you mean when you say colored?
So South Africa does have a racial category, which, you know, if we're going to talk about kind of the social construction of race, colored will be something that was made in 1948 for people of like mixed race descent.
Gotcha.
So that, you know, maybe kind of Creole would be a word to describe them, or mixed race. But, you know, it's not first generation where you have a white parent and a Black parent. It's kind of historically. So that group of people are called colored people.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate that. Magat, I hear you in terms of not being intimidated by the specter of racism. I do also hear the counter argument that Tandiwe, I think, is trying to make in terms of the need for people to be included in the situation, to view that they are part of and connected to this legacy that they now have to help consciously unpack and consciously dismantle. And it's not good enough to say, but I'm a nice person. Is there room for that, for people to both believe in merit and be conscious of the legacy of race?
I mean, of course, yeah. To be both conscious of a concept of merit, and again, I will keep defending merit and meritocracy, as well as saying, did things happen in the past that were not right? Absolutely. But there, right there, Joshua, I want to stop for a second. I really believe that we Black people would do ourselves a huge favor if we just we're willing to also look at the whole world and look at the whole history of what I call humanity, okay? So when it comes to that, slavery is truly a human history. It's a human, it's something that we all share. I don't actually know of any society that in the past has not been enslaved at some point. The history of man has been to enslave one another. I really think that that part of the history, we need to have it right. So what good is it going to do me to go and try to make Black people, white people feel discomfort? Why? Because supposedly I have felt discomfort, or my ancestors have felt discomfort. What good is it going to do me to try and be like, slap for slap, you take it now? so that maybe 100 years from now, their children will be like, oh, you've been slapping us for the past 100 years, so now it's going to be our turn. Because guess what? This is just what is going to happen. It's just going to be this infinite, vicious cycle of hate and violence against each other. So my point is, what good is it going to do us to be like tit for tat? What is that going to do?
Well, I do wonder, Magat, also with regard to the what you describe as kind of a cycle, right? That the recrimination will keep coming back, that it could yield violence and so on. And there have been violent backlashes towards all kinds of efforts to enfranchise, disenfranchise people. That is well known. I have heard versions of this argument in a lot of different places, in a lot of different parts of the world. And advocates for programs like this, it always comes back to why they, and I'm not trying to put words in Tandiwe's mouth. Tandiwe, if you disagree with this, I will give you a moment to say so. But I've heard a number of advocates say, I don't care what your feelings are. This is a historical wrong. It needs to be righted. I'm sorry this makes you uncomfortable, but so did racism. And you are feeling a fraction of what people have actually felt, inflicted upon them in material ways. Your feelings just have to wait for a little while so we can solve this problem, and then we can all feel good about the solution. How would you respond to that?
The truth is, Joshua, I don't really care about your feelings. I really don't care. I don't care that as a white person, you're going to say, oh my God, I didn't do anything wrong to you. I was the innocent one. I don't know what my ancestors have done to you and blah, blah, blah. I'm one of the good people. I sincerely don't care about any of that. Do you know what I care about? I care about the fact that Black people today, and most importantly, the Black people of tomorrow, get a better, fairer, you know, chance. That's all I care about. What happened in the past, there is nothing that I can do about it. But my future, you betcha that there's everything that I can and have to do about. I'm all about making the pie bigger. I'm going to make my piece of a pie that I want, and that's it. I'm not interested in anything that people have gotten, whether they got it in an ill way found. It's not good if they got it in an ill way found. If they got it legitimately, whatever that is, where I'm coming from, I think it's much better, at least for me, to just be building a bigger pie. So this idea that the pie is fixed and therefore we have to fight for it, not for me. And so when you talk about the power, they have to let it go. I don't care. Keep your power, because I'm going to build much more, because that's how confident I am in myself.
My God, hold on one second. I just need to jump in for just one second. I do want to give Tandiwe a chance. Tandiwe, what about that? The possibility that even if these programs do work, that the backlash could be very real and could create new setbacks. Many different movements for enfranchisement and equality and equity have been met with a very intense clapback. Sometimes that creates a new set of problems just by virtue of the backlash. What about that aspect of race-conscious affirmative action and race-based programs?
I mean, for me, though, that is kind of what we talk about the work, right? You're still kind of continuing dealing with the backlash. There will be that, because I don't think anyone lets go of power just so easily, especially if you worked for like centuries and generations to engineer it to a point that we are here discussing this thing between ourselves, right? So I don't think it's something to run away from. I think that in itself also kind of goes back to this like kind of Black excellence, that we are doing all of this even though the stakes are so high. So I kind of don't really understand why affirmative actions and policies that address historical injustices that still continue, that still lead to marginalization, is seen as tit for tat, though. So I'm kind of lost in that.
I do wonder, and Tandiwe, I'm going to come right back to you in a second. I do wonder, Magat, though, how you deal with things that are zero sum. For example, political power. There are only so many seats in parliament, right? There are only so many votes to go around. There are only so many districts that are created. And if you want to, for example, change at-large voting districts to regional districts, which is one of the big fights in many parts of the world to try to enfranchise, disenfranchise peoples, you have to get into the system as it exists, with the structural flaws and barriers as they exist. So I hear you in terms of making the pie bigger, Magat, in some places, But in other parts of society, the ingredients are limited by design and there is no bigger pie. You have to change it or you're stuck.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Joshua. And that premise that you seem to have accepted based on how you stated your question is simply a premise that I don't share. I don't share this idea that political power necessarily follows economic power, which for me is the most important one, economic power. And I'll give you examples for that. Right now, you know, whether you're looking at the U.S. Congress or you're looking at the mayors of the four most populous, you know, and biggest cities in America, who are the mayors? Black mayors. The Congress is some crazy number of Black people in Congress. So I'm not sure that I buy into this idea that political power equals economic power. And if you have to ask me which one matters the most, I still will stand with economic power. That's a question maybe that you can have for me next. But I'm just not accepting that premise of yours. And therefore, I go back to what I said. The pie can be grown and it can be grown to suit us.
Tandiwe, let me let you jump back in. I know you've got a couple of things that you'd like to address.
I mean, firstly, I do agree that political power is not the same as economic power. That's something that's, you know, you'll talk about kind of a generational divide within South Africa where it's like, yes, our political rights have happened, but now there's kind of like economic freedom that is not there for us as Black people. So I'm not disputing that kind of there's that this thing is not holistic, that you have political freedom means you have economic freedom. That's not a point of contention on my end. I think also, yes, this was the point I wanted to make. It's just like the invisibility of whiteness. We cannot ignore that to be like, oh, I don't care. It doesn't mean that I don't care about the structures that disadvantage other people. There's a lot of individualism in that, and individualism is kind of a very Western idea of just like, well, this is me, I'm gonna do it. Let's forget about other people that are suffering and the reasons why they're suffering, because I could make it one man, then it means everyone can make it. And I think it's dangerous to be like that. And I remember as well, kind of as a younger middle class person, it's just kind of like, well, racism is not so bad. I go to school with white people. And then you grow up and you're just like, it is bad. Just because I was lucky doesn't mean that's the standard. And in factual fact, I study poor white. So I studied this whiteness that doesn't go to socially acceptable whiteness in itself. These are white people who are kind of thrown away by mainstream whiteness, but they're also the group of people that was a real reason why Apartheid was built, because it was like shock horror. How do we allow these group of people to be poor when we have painted our entire identity on being superior? So there were very deliberate actions to uplift and rehabilitate white people, poor whites, into socially acceptable whiteness. So I don't see why now it becomes a problem when we're trying to uplift, we're trying to get equitability, we're trying to not constantly be disenfranchised. I can't see how that is problematic.
I did want to get into some of that, I think, with the two of you. I know there's so much into this that we could dig into, but we've got two people who've been listening to the whole conversation. They may ask some of these questions as well. Let me start with Mariam Rakik, who is a finance master student at the Université Paris-Dauphine from Tunisia. Also, we have Ruben Sapitulu, who is a sociology student at the University of Zambia in Lusaka. Mariam Rakik, let me start with you. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much, Joshua. So I really appreciated listening to the both of you, and I really understand like the background of everyone and how you may disagree, let's say, on some points. But actually, my question, what popped in my mind when hearing about South Africa, the experience of South Africa and all. And so I want to ask Tandwe about your opinion on the quotas. We know that quotas have been a contentious issue in South Africa, and they have been implemented in many sectors to ensure the diversity between Black people and white people in several sectors, as I said, to actually implement inclusion. So I want to ask actually your opinion about them. And do you think, are they efficient? And don't you think that in some companies or in some specific sectors, they are set only to address racial inequality just in a surface, not deeply and not concretely?
Yeah. No, you're right. I can't disagree with what you're saying. You know, it becomes kind of like that face almost to be like, okay, we've done our work when no real work is done. And then also you have these people who do complain that, like, you get into this job and there's not much, you don't have any real power, there's not much you can do. So also at the same time, these things aren't going to work overnight. I think there's a bit of an impatience, you know. I think even here in the States with the overruling of affirmative action by the Supreme Court, I don't know how long affirmative action has been around for it to be like, well, no, we're done with it. I think, you know, things are, should be allowed to, like, kind of, you should be allowed to work on your kinks. There was also, I think Maged had mentioned, kind of like these kinks. And yeah, what's policy and practice are not necessarily always the same. But I do believe that all of this is a work in progress. You know, we are trying to engineer, socially engineer, an more equitability.
Ruben Sapetulu, let me get to you and your question. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much. And I think the question that was pretty much speaking to individual needs, because I do know that, you know, challenges at a society level may differ. Sometimes I know we are talking about colorblindness, but sometimes it could be between genders. Sometimes it could be, you know, between several other factors. So what I wanted to just understand is, how do we make society just and responsive to individual needs, if not through targeted measures? And when I mean targeted measures, I'm not explicitly pointing to just colorblindness, but of course, targeted measures in general.
Look, I don't think when you say to make the world more fair, more just, first of all human beings, the 8 billion people on this earth, I believe that as a whole, most of us, minus 1% of us psychopaths, would want just to live happy, healthy, productive lives, caring for ourselves and our families and pursuing, you know, that which makes us happy. Now, how does that get done? Last time I checked, for me, it's that human flourishing happens through having, you know, through prosperity. And so how do you build prosperity? You have to focus on, you know, economic freedom. And here, economic freedom, not to be confused with financial freedom. Financial freedom is what happens after you have economic freedom. Economic freedom just means a sane business climate so your entrepreneurs can enterprise. So for me, really, that's where it's at. It's like, make sure that people have jobs and or create companies and or are the recipients of the jobs from these companies, from which income they get to go and build the lives that they want to build, get to have a protection that they need to have. And then from there, it's everybody's you know, chance to just build the life that they want to build. I don't think what a good life is for you, Ruben, is up to some policies and the state or government to decide what it is, because what is good for you might be very different from what's good for me. What I believe in is give people the economic independence to make those choices, to leave and lead the type of lives that they want. For that to happen, I don't believe race-based policies are necessary. That's all I was trying to say.
Tandiwe, how would you respond to Ruben's question for you?
I heard Ruben talk about, like, targeted policies and whatnot. I think they're, personally, I've been the reciprocant of that. You know, as I'm a poultry farmer, I was able to get funded as a younger Black woman. Will that funding put me in the same competition as, or the same level as these, like, older white male farmers who really take over agriculture? No, but it really just helped. It gave me a little bit of a step up. It has addressed, it brought me closer into competing in the agricultural space, which women have definitely not been part of. Black women have not been part of. So I even, just as an individual, can see the benefits that it's had.
Tandiwe, it sounds like your vision of what this would mean would not just lift people up along racial lines, but also along socioeconomic lines, considering that there are historic connectors through poverty that would also kind of bridge gaps there as well. Am I hearing you right?
Precisely. And then also, you also have to remember, on a South African context, our thing is not that long ago. We had colonialism, we had imperialism, we had apartheid. 30 years now only do we have our political freedom, but we don't have our economic freedom. So it's not this distant, far away thing. It's here in our eyes.
It is kind of remarkable when you think about it that in 2024, we are 30 years away from the formation of that democratic government in 1994. It is very much living memory. Magat, same question, but the flip side of that. If we could advocate more of the kinds of policies that you've been talking about that were not as race conscious, what is the vision as you see it for what that would look like?
The vision that I see is people engaging more in a culture of prosperity rather than a culture of poverty. The example that I will give there is something that I have seen with my own eyes in South Africa. I go there often. I just came back, and on all of my drives, I was talking, most of the time my Uber drivers were Black African immigrants, meaning they're not South African Black natives. So in this case, countless stories of Black immigrants making it, starting from a journey of nothing to a journey of a lot. And meanwhile, having to go through some of the worst treatments from Black South Africans, based also on resentment, because they're not understanding or accepting how come you come here and you are able to make it. Meanwhile, you have all of these race-based affirmative, policies in South Africa that actually give people such a level of welfare that, hey, why do I have to get up in the morning and go do something? So I think it would be very interesting for the rest of us to really look at what's going on right there between Black immigrants and Black South Africans. Because I think once you put race out of a picture, you start to really see the real culprits. And in this case, I will call it, and whether it's in South Africa or other parts of Africa or in the US or Brazil, white people, Black people, there is such a thing called culture of poverty versus culture of prosperity. So for me, we need to focus on that culture of prosperity, which makes people, get up and do things for themselves. And
but people are doing things from themselves.
Why are they not doing it right now in South Africa?
But they are.
Why
you are they not doing it? Why are people just sit like this? Everyone, even when we talk about these things, we still do our work. We still have to get up. We still have to work hard. Everybody.
Tandiwe, before we have to wrap up, I did want to ask you, I forgot to ask you this earlier. How do you believe that these kinds of race-conscious programs might affect racism in Africa in a broader sense? Do we expect these programs to make places less racist, or do we expect them to just be a different kind of a benefit to society while you work on the deeper ideological issues of racism in a different way? How do those two things, as you see it, Tandiwe, how do those two things intersect?
So definitely no, I don't think it's going to make it less racist, but definitely a little bit more fair. I think it would probably, as we're seeing, I think we're seeing a lot of expression of kind of racist views. I think it's making white people express their racism because they're feeling threatened. So is it going to remove racism? No, it's not, but it is going to allow for more fairness, where just because white people being threatened doesn't mean that there's so much action that can come behind it that's detrimental to overall kind of progression.
We've spent this debate talking about the areas where the two of you disagree, where you see things differently, and I'm very grateful that you laid out your views so clearly and so passionately. We always like to end with areas of common ground, an agreement. Magat, let me start with you. Where do you see areas where you and Tandiwe more or less see eye to eye on this, despite all the differences?
I think that Tandiwe is rightfully outraged by the injustices of the past. Absolutely. And I feel the same way she does about it, for sure. And I also think we I think she would like to see a world in which there is less racism. Same with me. And in my case, I actually believe we can get to a place where 80% of racism as we know it can go poof in the air if we go for prosperity building. That's what I believe. So those are the places where I feel that both Tandy Way and I are on the same page, at least from where I'm seeing it. Maybe I'm mistaken, but that's where I see us, you know, having some agreements.
And Tandy Way, before we go, where do you see areas of common ground between you and Magette?
I mean, definitely the whole kind of like Black excellence, African pride. I'm all about that. We don't need to be intimidated, you know? I'm all about kind of erasing the inferiority complex. I also do agree what you're saying. South Africa, and it's not a secret, South Africa is, we call it xenophobic, but it is specifically Afrophobic. There is a lot of Black South Africans being very unaccepting of Black, what we call Black African national, African foreign nationals that come to South Africa. So no, that's like, you know, not a figment of imagination. That is a thing. But yeah, I do really truly believe that whole like Black people, we don't, especially Africans, we're not beneath. I'm very much about that.
Tandy Way and Chinga, I appreciate you making time for this debate. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And Magette Wade, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks also to Mariam Rikik and Ruben Sapitulu joining us from Paris and Zambia. Glad to have had you both as well. Doha Debates is a production of Qatar Foundation. Our podcast is produced by FP Studios and Doha Debates. Our producers include Mandy Lester, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Claudia Tatey, and Anna Peterson. FP Studios Managing Director is Rob Sachs. Our executive producers are Katrine Dermody, Japhet Weeks, Amjad Atala, and Jigar Mehta. To learn more about Doha Debates, you can go to Doha Debates, that's DOHA Debates.com, where you can find out about our other podcasts, short films, upcoming events, and more. And please, if you like this podcast, leave us a review on your podcast app and follow the program so you never miss an episode. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening.